You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters Live. Welcome to the podcast that showcases the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Today we're asking, how will consumers be affected by new HFSS regulations? Will the restrictions on the promotion of products high in fat, salt, and sugar actually change people's lives in a positive way? The idea behind the proposals is to improve public health, but will we actually develop new healthy shopping habits once the regulations come in? Now, this episode was recorded in April 2022. A few weeks later, the government announced a delay to the introduction of some of the proposed changes. As things stand in June of the same year, these are the dates we're working to. A ban on buy one, get one free deals on food and drink that's high in fat, salt and sugar, as well as free refills for soft drinks, has been postponed by 12 months and won't be introduced before October 2023. Plans to restrict TV advertising of HFSS products before the 9 o'clock watershed have also been delayed by a year until January 2024. But restrictions on where HFSS products can be placed in shops will still go ahead in October 2022. The new delays have caused lots of controversy, and no doubt we will revisit the topic in the weeks ahead. But for now, let's dig into the behavioural science and ask what happens when our favourite foods are no longer quite so visible. I was delighted to be joined on the podcast by Malcolm Clark, Senior Prevent Policy Manager at Cancer Research UK, and Hannah Skeggs, Health and Sustainable Diets Manager at IGD. I hope you enjoy the episode. Now, we clearly have a huge obesity problem as a nation. That's one of the issues, but there are also dietary issues as well. Now, if these HFSS changes go as well as possible, in the most positive scenario, Malcolm, what do you think, what sort of change might we see in public health?
Well, I mean, you're starting from a point of view that overweight and obesity is the biggest preventable cause of cancer after smoking in the UK, linked to 13 different types of cancer, including bowel, breast and pancreatic cancers. And overweight and obesity disproportionately affects the UK's most deprived, with children from more deprived areas twice as likely to be obese than those from more affluent areas. And as we know that an obese child is five times more likely to be obese as an adult, acting early is critical. And so I think the starting point is these kind of population-wide measures to improve the nation's health, reducing disparities, is a really good starting point. I don't have specific impact on the promotions restrictions, but in terms of if we were looking at the advertising restrictions, the government's own numbers on its impact assessment says that would reduce the number of children with obesity by more than 20,000. Actually, the scale of the impact would be much larger, partly because that only takes into account children, but it is, you know, adults as well buying these products, yeah, being affected by promotions and advertising. There will be changes to adults' diets. And I say none of that was taken into account into the impact assessment. And also it is those ripple effects that I think we'll talk about, but on the incentives for reformulation, for innovation in the food industry, and I guess the potential change to long-term dietary habits through what's happening, that means that this is the starting point for a much wider sort of change in the type of food that we eat, and that balance to try and reduce the number of excess calories in our diet. This is not the be-all and end-all, and I think that's very important to kind of note that. But I think it is a really useful starting point to see how we can drive things that have got stuck over the last numbers of years with companies struggling to make the changes, the make retailers wanting to make change, but because they haven't been able to do it on their own, because I say competitive disadvantage, as it were, losing out to what their fear of losing out to what their competitors are doing. Ultimately, from an industry point of view, yeah, we have things set up, whether through monopolies and mergers commissions or through other regulation, that means that the only way of doing these things really from both a legal and a commercial point of view is through legal route of restrictions. And that, yeah, hopefully should be a good step.
I think it's interesting that you say that this is a starting point for wider change. Now, that's quite exciting. What do you see as being the next steps to really make this work and to make it entrenched in British dietary habits?
I just want to go back one step, just to kind of from an evidence base. Yeah, the evidence shows that volume-based price promotions, the bog-offs, etc., actually increase the amount people spend by 20%, and they stimulate impulse purchasing of cheap snacks, high in fat, salt, and sugar. Yeah, often displacing more nutritious produce, store cupboard staples. And our own research at Cancer Research UK shows that regular purchasers of these multi-buy deals on HFSS are more likely to be obese or overweight, increasing the risk of diet-related ill health. So I think from an evidence point of view, current situation is nudging people in unhealthy ways, both in terms of excess calories, but also actually, as importantly at the moment as well, in terms of excess pounds that they're spending. So I think that's the starting point, is you do need, as I said, evidence-led interventions to improve public health. But hopefully on the marketing, on the advertising, with the restrictions to HFSS advertising on TV before 9 p.m. and online,
yeah,
that's obviously what we've been really calling for, what our evidence at Cancer Research UK and our surveys of young people show will be impactful. I guess that further work around reducing the unhelpful nudges, both from promotions, marketing, in all its forms, is certainly the thing that we're looking for. But also, what further steps to incentivize industry to reformulate or industry change? Because I think that's what works best. Yeah, whether it's on the shelf, what goes in our shopping baskets, what would, you know, any other change is the easy choice. It's easier if things are almost done to us, if our favourite products are reformulated, you know, rather than having to go out and, you know, have all this advertising telling us to buy something different, a new product that may not be, maybe less available, might be a higher price or whatever. It's better if those standard things that we're used to, and that we're a sucker for, because we're all creatures of habit. You know, if those things can get changed, that would be a really powerful step.
Okay, so Hannah, what I'm interested in here is do you think that this is going to work? So reducing visibility, making things full price, and the bog-offs have been a thorn in everyone's side for a long time, I think. Do you think that these new changes will change consumption? I hear what Malcolm said. I'd like to see some solid evidence that, you know, long-term nutritional research to talk about effective dietary change is immensely difficult to achieve. Are there some references from other countries, for instance, who've done similar things, or other ways that we can tell what is likely to happen?
Well, I think firstly we have to appreciate that the scale of these changes are really unseen anywhere before. So yes, there have been lots of small studies and things that have happened across the globe, but I don't think we've seen anything on this scale across all of retail before. Now, that being said, there is loads of research into behaviour change and choice architecture. And what it shows is that our behaviour is incredibly complex. So no one intervention is really going to be the be-all and end-all. Studies in stores, the out-of-home setting and focus groups have often shown that actually by changing a product's placement, whether it's incentivized and whether it's signposted, can really impact on sales. And I think where we'll really see these restrictions coming in and having an impact is in impulse shopping. So we've done some Shopper Vista research that shows that secondary locations, which is what we're talking about when we're saying gondola ends, for example, play a couple of really important roles. So the first thing that they do for shoppers is they give this kind of opportunity for products to be seen and to be purchased. But actually, more importantly for shoppers, when we did some eye tracking research, is that they remind shoppers to come into an aisle and to look into a specific category location. So if you take that away and you reframe those kind of nudges to come down the aisle and immerse yourself into the sweets, the chocolate bars, the crisps, then actually you will start to see some real differences, I think, in shopping.
Yeah.
What I don't think will change is if somebody walks into a store intending to buy a chocolate bar or intending to buy a birthday cake, I don't think that will change. But we should see a change in impulse shopping. with regards to kind of those promotional mechanics, when we spoke to shoppers, actually multi-buys really are unlikely to be missed. People buy those entirely on impulse. They're not actively looking for them.
Do I get a sense of sort of good riddance from you there? Are you pleased to see the back of them?
I think it's an interesting one. I mean, nobody wants the price of food to go up, but actually these kind of multi-buys aren't really encouraging people to buy less food. They're just buying more, and they tend, from evidence perspective, to eat them then at the same rate that they would have eaten one packet or 20% less. Yeah. So I think the government has left a lot of promotional mechanics still available. That's one that I'm not so sad to see the back of. And one of the mechanics that is still available is a price reduction. And when we spoke to shoppers, 62% of shoppers prefer a price reduction. That can remain. You could still sell a chocolate bar at 20p cheaper than it normally was. You could do an everyday low price promotion. You just can't encourage someone to buy an extra product.
Which makes a lot of sense. Malcolm, you glad to see the back of Bog-Offs?
Absolutely. We're pleased to see it. And I say, like Hannah said, kind of our surveys show that exactly the same. These are things that get people buying things that they don't, impulse purchases that they wouldn't necessarily have done otherwise, or in quantities they wouldn't otherwise have thought. So that's a positive. One thing I'm really interested in is this thing of what you put in its place, or what goes in its place of the HFSS. And we did some research based on the categories and the promotions restrictions from the leading companies and leading brands and the leading products. And we looked at that and saw, okay, here are in each of these categories, the five leading HFSS products. What could these companies substitute in its place? And out of that, we found across the various categories, we found 40% of the products could be directly swapped for another product in that same range produced by that company, but would be non-HFSS. So these products...
With a different formulation, basically.
With a different formulation, exactly. With less sugar, or fewer calories, less salt, that type of thing. So for almost half of these products, 40%, the alternatives are already there that can be done. And then when we looked at what the parent company does, all of their different brands, we found that over 80% of these products could then be swapped for something within the parent company's range that could be marketed instead.
Okay, that's quite interesting, isn't it? But are we massively missing a trick here? You know, shouldn't the government step in and say, okay, we're going to take a chunk of money from the useless public health campaigns that don't achieve anything, and we are going to sponsor carrots and cucumbers and radishes and some fantastic fruit, and we will pay the premium that the supermarkets are getting from companies to put their products on the end aisle, and basically sponsor healthy food. Would that work, do you think?
You already have an initiative like that, which is the Healthy Start voucher scheme for those who are in the most deprived areas and on low incomes,
but that's nudging the consumer rather than nudging the industry, isn't it?
Yes, and I was also going to say that those schemes are not as well advertised and accessible as we would like. But yes, partly what you're talking about is a much more considered view on our food and farming in the landscape and the food availability questions, which I know Henry Dimbleby addressed in his independent food strategy, which the government is yet to respond to, because I think it is more complicated than simply here's some cheaper fruit and veg. Supermarkets already do some of that.
Are you saying that joined up thinking across health, nutrition and government might work? What an extraordinary idea. It's a bigger project, isn't it? Which is hopefully what the ball is starting to roll on anyway, isn't it? So Hannah, what...
But I do, I know I was just going to say, I think there are, that looking across the piece, there are also things that you could do, retailers could do, which are around the nudges to other products which are healthier swaps. It isn't just about fruit. For instance, it's products that are higher in fiber, switching kind of to whole grain rice and pasta, for instance. And there are other things, other swaps like that, that can be encouraged through the store architecture that would be helpful.
So Hannah, so can we just bring this back to evidence that we've got? Because we've seen other recent attempts to change what's in our food and drink. We've had the sugar reduction program in England, the soft drinks industry levy. What can we learn from those projects, and how do you think it might impact what we're talking about today?
So I think the soft drinks industry levy that you mentioned was really successful in a number of ways. What I need to caveat there is that one size just doesn't fit all, and that soft drinks are comparatively easy to reformulate compared to other food categories. But what was really interesting in the soft drinks industry levy was there was a very sort of large scale industry movement, I think, as well as a government movement to reduce sugar at that time. So actually, if you look at the 5 years before the levy even came in, soft drinks decreased in sugar by an average of 23%. Now, between the announcement of the levy in 2016 and its implementation in 2018, over 50% of drink manufacturers managed to reduce their sugar content even further. So add on that fiscal pressure and suddenly the costs to reformulate seem a lot easier to bear. Mm. And the levy came in, and I think what people forget is that there was a number of behaviour change interventions that essentially happened as a result of that levy coming in. So the first thing is that despite the fact this was a tax on manufacturers, some of that was passed on to consumers. So if you walk down an aisle in Tesco's now, what you see is that full sugar Coke is more expensive per mil than Diet Coke is. So a customer has to make a choice as to whether or not they're happy to pay that extra amount for their regular drink. The second thing is that we saw HFSS advertising restrictions come in at a similar sort of time. And so a lot of advertising spend shifted out of sugary drinks and into diet alternatives. So if you watch an advert, it's normally for Pepsi Max, it's normally for Diet Coke, it's normally for a diet drink. And they've got fantastic music soundtracks, there's lots of beautiful imagery, and suddenly diet drinks are looking far more exciting. So what we saw was actually in the 1 year post levy, 18% of shoppers claimed that they'd swapped to a no or low sugar drink out of the full fat variety. So these were regular shoppers of colas and things. And 4% had cut out soft drinks entirely. So it wasn't just reformulation, it was the whole behaviour change that I find really interesting and is fab.
And again, it's sort of joined up thinking, isn't it, that achieves the change.
Absolutely. In other categories, that isn't necessarily so simple, and that's not me trying not to do it. I think we need to do stuff, but I think we need to take that multifaceted approach. So there was a massive independent McKinsey analysis done in 2014, and it suggested that reformulation would be about 8 times more effective in reducing obesity than a 10% tax on sugar. But actually, reducing portion size would be 10 times more effective than tax. And portion size is a lot easier in some ways. Now, it's not from a manufacturing perspective, but actually, when you reformulate and you take out sugar or you take out fat, you've got to put something else in. Mm. And sometimes that's sweeteners and thickeners and texturizers and things that, firstly, customers don't want to see in an ingredients list. Secondly, people don't like the taste of them, and taste is key. If you reformulate to a point where the customer no longer likes your product, they will just switch brand. And so it doesn't matter if you've now got a low sugar baked bean, because they're going to buy the one that they like the taste of. Mm. So I think portion size, if it was done consistently across the industry, is a real opportunity, because people can still enjoy their favorite products, the same great flavors. But if we cut portion size slowly but surely across the board, I think that could be very effective.
Yeah. Now, Malcolm, I think everyone's talked about the concept of food poverty and the impact on people who have less money to spend on their food. Do we know anything about how these changes are likely to affect different socioeconomic groups? Are the changes structured in a way that takes into account that different people have different amounts of money to spend on food? What's your view on the impact on people?
When we did our research a couple of years ago into volume-based promotions, we found there was actually no statistically significant difference of their usage according to somebody's income. There are other levers, that, such as price reductions, that people rely on more for some of these, for getting really good offers and cheap food. So from that point of view, it's a good population-wide measure that should do no harm. I think from its implementation point of view, already different supermarkets, different retailers already use the different types of promotions and location promotions in different ways. So already there's kind of a differential depending on which store you shop at,
yeah,
what you're impacted by. What I think we're particularly interested in now is that these promotion restrictions only affect, I say, medium and large stores and businesses. We want to ensure that they are properly implemented in franchise stores, with smaller stores, but part of a larger range. But also what we don't know is how different people might use sort of smaller convenience stores, independent stores, you know, things that aren't covered in the restrictions, particularly from a location-based point of view, and whether there is a difference, both not just in terms of income, but also, yeah, maybe different communities and different cultures using different types of shops. So I don't think the research has been done to that level to give a firm impact. So I say these things do need to be continued to be looked at. But the impact of income inequality is certainly there in terms of a factor of how people look at healthy behaviours. And so things that are nudging them towards spend whatever money you do have towards healthier products and not towards the most unhealthy products, that's got to be a good thing for people. And in terms of the promotions restrictions, I say this the conversation was already had. They were already reduced in terms of the numbers of categories that they were put to that are not on the bulk of kind of what you could call staple foods. So they are primarily targeted at the impulse purchase, so sweets and snacks for the promotions restrictions, the advertising restrictions in terms of TV on online coming in next year are across a wider variety of products, but these are only on a smaller variety as well. So I think that's useful to know.
Yeah.
I think I would disagree that it's a small variety, because I think those 13 categories are very broad, in as much as anything that's suitable for reheating. So, you know, the likes of Roche yogurts. I don't think we're just talking about cakes and sweets here. I do think that actually those 13 categories span most of the supermarket.
Mm. Okay, so we've talked about the effect on people who don't have a huge amount to spend on things. But I mean, the big issue, especially about obesity, and I take your point, Malcolm, that there are lots of other issues. It's not just about obesity. But let's take this in particular, because primary school changes in levels of obesity from when children enter school and when they leave school are hideous and dramatic. Hannah, how do you think that these changes will affect children? And I mean, is there a large scale evidence based study plan to be able to track whether or not this has had any effect?
Well, I think it's interesting because I will take the children bit first, but actually, I think as the obesity policy has evolved, we're talking less and less about childhood obesity policy and more about obesity policy in general. So I think we need to be looking at impact across the board. But yeah, if I go back to children for a second, actually, pester power is a huge, huge issue for families. So about 9 in 10 parents agree that it's a challenge. And I'm sure recently we've all seen children throwing temper tantrums in store because they want an Easter egg. So I think, again, it comes back to this reduction of impulse purchasing. But I also feel that there's a real opportunity for us to use that pester power for good. So a report done by Sustain showed that about 91% of parents agree that using family-friendly characters resulted in children asking for a product.
Yeah.
And that those are typically associated with unhealthy foods. But actually, a lot of the retailers have been doing work to try and move that onto healthier products. So Sainsbury's created a nationwide intervention with Disney Heroes. So they were available on things like easy peeling oranges, mini bananas, apples and pears. And they saw a 72% rise in sale on things like lower sugar beans. 387% rise in sales of those fruit that I mentioned. And that was in a 6-week intervention period that was compared to the previous year.
Right.
And that research was done by Oxford University. Now, unfortunately, it showed no sustained increase in sales once you took those stickers off. So really, you're seeing the impact of those characters, and further research is needed, but it's a start. And also Tesco's did a similar intervention that you might be familiar with, offering free fruit at the front of store.
Yes, absolutely.
So that was so that your kids could have a nice banana whilst going around the store, not feel so hungry, hopefully put less in the basket. But actually, it caused 2/3 of shoppers to buy more fruits and vegetables than they used to. And quite excitingly, 3/4 of parents said that the initiative had made their shopping trip easier, and that 65% of their kids wanted to eat more fruit and veg thanks to the scheme. So I have real high hopes, not actually just for the regulation, but what happens by breaking the norm and by using pester power for good.
Malcolm, we talked a little bit about whether or not this is enough, whether this is the first stage of something else. Do these changes go far enough for you? And what else would you like to see happening, either from the government side or even, heaven knows, from the food industry, you know, coming up with a set of restrictions on themselves?
I mean, these are a good start. I mean, there are still some things just to work out and see particularly what happens on the online retail space. It is obviously one that is newer and less considered. So although these restrictions do apply, yeah. And we certainly don't want to see, it's absolutely right. People are still going to go in and buy a chocolate bar, as Hannah said, if that, or a cake, if that's their intention. What we don't want to see is the retailers moving the different types of promotions of HFSS onto different aisles. Yeah, let's just keep the products and any promotional activity that might go on with them to the aisles that they are meant to be should really be a philosophy. You know, it has become more and more common to see bags of sweets hanging up in different random aisles in the supermarket, and seasonal things being promoted in lots of different aisles. So I think there is a case of how do you keep the retailers look to keep the spirit as well as the letter of these restrictions. I guess the next stage is, and these are picked up, we did a survey of young people, our Youth Obesity Policy Survey, which we do every 2 years at Cancer Research UK. And I said the most recent findings we published were that, you know, not only the recall of HFSS marketing amongst young people remain high, but they highlighted new advertising, including TikTok, but food delivery apps, and I guess it is, and had high recognition of HFSS brands, and none of the restrictions, certainly the marketing restrictions, look at the brand aspect itself. That's certainly one area that, you know, is still a concern. And again, as has been touched on, how do you ensure that those promotional techniques on the packaging itself are used for good and not to keep on not using the tricks of the trade to keep on encouraging pester power and encouraging children to be attracted to products that are HFSS. So that's the starting point. But I think the really big thing kind of for 2022 going into 2023 is the fact that the sugar reduction program will be from the government, what was being led by PHE, I guess is now being led by Office of Health Improvement and Disparities. That's coming to an end. And what happens next? You've got a very uneven distribution of companies and categories in terms of the progress that's been made. Yes, some are easier than others, but that doesn't excuse, you know, an almost complete lack of progress in some areas. So again, you know, taking on board the work that Henry Dimbleby and the National Food Strategy has done, you know, looking at how do you put further incentives for industry to push ahead with that reformulation program, I think is going to be a really big thing coming up. My challenge to industry as well, I say my personal challenge actually, this is around the nutrient profile model, because ultimately, you know, in all what we're talking about, banding around HFSS, high fat sugar products, you have to use something to determine what that is, yeah, what we're talking about. And that model has been in place since 2007 or so. PHE led a review of the nutrient profile model a couple of years ago, involving experts, academics, and industry. They came up with a series of recommendations that fitted with new government advice to increase our fiber intake and reduce our sugar intake. And those new nutrient profile model recommendations have not been implemented. And that would be another start, just to kind of continue to nudge us towards, you know, slightly healthier products, which have more fiber and less sugar by implementing that. So that's my other thing that would be a really positive thing.
Yeah, yeah. So possibly some big changes yet to come as well, which could be, well, I'm sure they'll complain about them, but it could be very exciting. Now, Hannah, what's interesting about the food industry is that you know, talking about HFSS, there was, I mean, a huge outcry to begin with, complaints about cost and the effect of change. But then these things began to change and people started to say, okay, well, seeing as it's applied to everybody, hopefully, on a level playing field, there must be opportunities. Now, the supermarkets and the food industry are not trying to kill us. They want to make money from us. They must see that there are potentials from all this. What do you think the opportunities are, if any, for retailers, for specifically, once the new regulations come into force? Because they will be working like crazy to make advantages out of these restrictions. What are those likely to be, do you think?
I think there's a good few opportunities. So the first is that we know that not only are people looking for health when they go into store now, so about 85% of shoppers claim they're looking for health, but also investors are looking for health. So more and more we're seeing companies reporting on their environmental and social governance metrics. But I do think it's much broader than just a retail opportunity, and it's about what you do instead. So earlier you mentioned subsidising carrots. Now, at IGD, we've brought together a really passionate industry working group spanning retailers, manufacturers and out-of-home organisations to see what you can actually do it instead. So we're testing 5 theoretical behaviour change levers in real life settings and to try to shift consumers towards healthier and more sustainable diets so that we can see what actually works in the short term and the long term, but equally importantly, what doesn't. So to bring this to life in terms of scale, we already have data sharing agreements in place with 3 major retailers, and we're working to set up a good few more and run large scale trials across the nation. Those data sharing agreements allow us to see what's sold, not just in terms of a single transaction, but a basket to a person, their demographic. We can't see the person, obviously, but we know their household income, their demographic, whether they go back and purchase things.
It's me, isn't it? It's me that you're looking at.
It's amazing. We're tracking you specifically, Stefan. But our first published trial, we published in December last year, and it was with Sainsbury's, and we used 3 behaviour change levers to drive consumers towards new varieties of fruit and veg. So the first thing we did was we incentivized it. Earlier you mentioned offering carrots on promotion. So all of the fruits and veg that we offered were reduced to 60p to tackle a real issue with cost perception. Secondly, we placed those fruit and veg on gondola ends, so we really gave it that prominent space that we're taking away from HFSS items and pulling people into that fruit and veg category. And then finally, we used signposting through point of sale comms and posters. Now, that signposting tackled other barriers to change. So we know that people don't think of healthy food as tasty. They describe it as brown and boring. So the posters were really colourful. They were exciting. They heroed taste and low price messaging. They made it really fun and flavoursome. So, for example, one poster featured an aubergine dish and it said, comfort food can be healthy food. Yeah. Now, if I just summarise the initial findings of just this trial, and we've run 5 others to date, but we've got loads more in the pipeline. It ran in 101 stores for 2 4-week intervention periods, but we have 2 years of baseline data to account for COVID, and we've got 2 years of follow-up data that we're collecting. We analysed data from 23.4 million baskets, and during the intervention, 1.5 million baskets contained a promoted product. And basically what we saw was that promoted fruit and vegetables sold increased by 78%. So that's 4.9 million extra portions of fruit and veg just from one trial with one retailer. Now, we're running multiple trials with that retailer. We're running multiple trials with other retailers. And what we're looking at is that Eat Well guide. So if you cause someone to buy more fruit and veg, does it displace discretionary products? Does it displace impulse purchasing and HFSS? And that's fascinating. Now, on this particular trial, what we saw was actually, sadly, there wasn't a long-term sustained behaviour change. But in trials that I very much hope to be able to talk to you about soon, we are seeing long-term behaviour change. And those are trials that look into some of the other interventions we've talked about today. So things like healthy start vouchers and different categories, specifically where we're targeting different demographic groups. And we're finding that the more targeted you are, it seems the more long-term and more long-lasting behaviour is. So I find this really exciting. I think that there is so much more research to do to understand the opportunity. From my perspective, that opportunity is to have a nation that eats healthier. From a retailer, that might be to sell more fruit and veg. But so long as those things align and align now with the government, who really cares? I think what I'm finding really exciting at the moment is that for the first time, I do believe that government, retail and shoppers are on the same page. We all want to be healthier. And I think COVID has really, really brought that to the forefront of how our diets are connected with our health.
Yeah. Okay. And Malcolm, just one, I mean, slightly basic question for you. I mentioned this to Hannah earlier on, but we're only going to really learn from this if we get a large scale, evidence-based, well-designed study to track what happens. And in nutrition, this is immensely difficult. What do you think needs to be done to work out what is going to work from this and what the next stage will be?
You need to have sort of independent academic evaluation of these measures. I mean, that's something that was put in place in London when the mayor introduced an advertising ban on HFSS products on Transport for London sites. There was a good academic evaluation done of that. Same again, I believe, kind of is being put in place for some of the HFSS advertising restrictions coming in. But that's the base that needs, to be able to look across a broad range of statistics. And it isn't just about the long term view on weight and on the measurement of obesity. But as Hannah's suggested, there are other measures in terms of what's going on in your basket, what's going on across your, how does that then relate to your whole food consumption and calorie consumption? The issue here is that the retail environment is not only one area, but in some ways, certainly for some demographics, it's a reducing area of where they're getting their calories. I mean, it has been overall an average for many years because of the rise of out-of-home opportunities. And that's probably been accelerated even further through innovations across the pandemic and the rise of, So many more of us ordering in food, particularly now going back into workplaces and eating out, etc. That I think you've got a whole suite of area that isn't being looked at in this. So I think it's a challenge, but I do think that one of the key areas that you have to start looking at is the attitudes, and I think we've already used that word around normalization or denormalization. It is around how do you start doing things just exactly the soft drinks industry levy did, almost unintentionally, because it wasn't meant to be customer facing. But was that, many people don't refer to it as a sugary drinks tax, they refer to it as a sugar tax. And that's incorrect. There's something in there just as a bit of a nudge to people to go, I need to check on my sugar intake. And it's again here is how can these measures be used to nudge those both from an personal attitudes perspective, but actually then there's also from a an industry and a government perspective, how do you use this opportunity to take that further? And I think that for me is the main thing, is that this, as much as we all have those good intentions, it relies on the food industry and government itself to put in place the things that make, healthier habits easier to do. And I think that's the thing. There is so much of our lives that are impacted by nudges the wrong way at the moment, that while it's great that we have this, we have to keep on doing, keep on that pace. And as Hannah has said, that lovely trifecta between government, industry, and the public is there at the moment. Let's hope that there's lots of opportunities with the Health Disparities White Paper, further chapters of the Childhood Obesity Plan, and as we said, kind of how do you look at that across, not just children, but across the whole population, adults as well, to improve interventions that reduce the obesogenic environment and support a healthy weight. And there are many, many ways of doing that. But I do think ultimately it's the government that needs to keep leading this program and setting the pace that will then support the changes that are needed across the rest of it.
Fantastic. Okay. And Hannah, just one last comment from you.
Yeah, it was just about on how we measure success. And I think historically we have measured success of government programs through the National Diet and Nutrition Survey. And in many ways, that's a fantastic consumption-based survey. But if you take it at face value, we should have a very skinny population because there are so many issues with people reporting what they think they've consumed that it's just not very accurate.
Yes.
The other problem with NDNS data is it takes about 4 years from the point of collection for it to all be analysed and published, that I just don't think that's going to be fast enough for us to really understand the impact of HFSS. So I think purchasing is the best way to measure this in the short term because generally people eat what they do purchase and it allows us to see what they buy instead. So if people are buying less HFSS food, are calories actually going down in their baskets or have they swapped to something else and have we generated any unintended consequences? And it was when Malcolm mentioned the white paper that I thought we've got to mention the fact that in the National Food Strategy, Henry Dimbleby's recommendation, there was a real call for mandatory reporting and mandatory data sharing across industry into what is sold, especially around what is sold on HFSS foods and drinks. I mean, I think how that evolves and how policy comes out is really something that we need to be very mindful of because that is the logical way to track HFSS if there is no wider study going and if it comes to force.
Okay, well, we could carry on talking about this for hours, but we've already run out of time enormously. That's a fantastic episode on the potential impacts of HFSS with some absolutely fantastic guests with a huge depth of expertise. So I'm absolutely overjoyed to have had you. Malcolm Clark and Hannah Skeggs, thanks both of you for joining us. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are plenty more at foodmatterslive.com. For example, if you go to the site and search HFSS, you'll find all of our previous episodes on the subject, including how retailers and brands are preparing for the changes. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening.